Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. Laughter. It's a universal language, yet no one agrees on what makes something funny. For centuries, experts, academics, and philosophers have tried to explain how humor works and how it doesn't. Plato and Aristotle said it had to do with superiority. People laugh at the misfortune of others. Think schoolyard bullying or watching someone slip and fall. Sigmund Freud followed the relief theory, the idea that humor is a way to release pent-up energy. Then there's the incongruity theory, the idea that we laugh at things that surprise us. Think a talking fish or a bear walking into a bar. But our guest has a different theory. Peter McGraw, welcome to Think.
That's great to be here.
Okay, before you tell us your theory behind what makes jokes work, do you have one for us?
You know, I really should be more prepared for this question.
You should have lots lined up.
Well, most of them are not fit for public radio.
Ah, yes, that's understandable.
I do have one. It's actually a very nice illustration of my theory. It doesn't always translate on the air, but we can give it a try.
Let's try it.
Okay. I want you to ask me, what is the secret source to good comedy?
All right. What's the secret source?
Timing.
All right, that worked and made me feel a little bit like I have bad timing. So is embarrassment a factor there? Should I feel embarrassed?
Well, you know, it's one of those jokes that I think in many ways it's much funnier to a third person who's observing it than the person who's being subject to it.
Okay, so
but I do appreciate you laughing.
So yes, well, it was real. So what is the theory behind that, and how does that fit with your theory behind what makes something funny?
Well, so the theories that you were talking about in the introduction, if you look at them, I think a little bit more abstractly, a little more broadly, what you can do is find a kind of common element across them. And that is that there seems to be something wrong that's going on. And that's sort of the dirty little secret of humor, is that it has these potentially negative underpinnings, what we call in the Humor Research Lab violations. So Mark Twain recognized this in one of his quotes. He said, "The secret source of humor is not joy, but sorrow. There is no humor in heaven." So I hate to break it to people, but because heaven's a perfect place, there's nothing wrong there. There's nothing to laugh at. But of course, the things that are wrong, the things that are unsettling, the things that are threatening, they don't usually make us laugh. As Twain noted, they make us cry, or they disgust us, or they offend us. There needs to be something else there. And if you look at a whole group of other theories, mostly focused on play, you find that there's some other element that accompanies these things that are wrong, and that is that there's something okay, acceptable, or safe, or as we say, benign. And thus, what it is that we laugh at and we delight in and we feel amusement and we say, hey, that's funny, are benign violations, things that are wrong yet okay.
Now you give a great example in the book of this benign violation theory, which, by the way, doesn't have a very funny name, I have to say.
It is a little bit nerdy.
Yeah, well, it's sort of the Freakonomic style, so I like that. Now, you talk about this example of watching someone fall down a flight of stairs.
Yeah, so obviously when someone falls down a flight of stairs, the violation is really quite clear. Something bad has happened. There's something wrong there. But falling down a flight of stairs is not necessarily funny. There has to be something else happening there. So the person has to arrive at the landing okay in some way. And they often indicate that they're okay by laughing. Or maybe you just don't really like that person falling down the stairs very much. And that's connected to this idea of superiority theory. So Immanuel Kant talked about sudden glory. And so having your enemy fall down a flight of stairs is a moment of sudden glory. Or in our words, it's a benign violation.
Now, but what you say here, which I thought made it pretty clear how your theory works, is that, you know, walking down a flight of stairs in of itself is not very funny. You do it all the mm-hmm. time. And falling but not getting hurt at all, that's a little bit funny. But falling and, you know, breaking your femur, that's just not funny at all.
No, yeah. So one of the things that a theory of humor should do is it should not only explain what makes things funny, but what makes things not funny. And the illustration that you just gave demonstrates that there's two ways that an attempt at comedy can fail. It can be too benign, walking down a flight of stairs, or it could be too much of a violation, someone getting badly hurt.
Now, Louis C.K., who, of course, has just skyrocketed in terms of popularity, he plays a lot with pushing the situation from benign to being a violation. Let's listen to a clip.
Of course, children who have nut allergies need to be protected. Of course. We have to segregate their food from nuts, have their medication available at all times. And anybody who manufactures or serves food needs to be aware of deadly nut allergies. Of course. But maybe, if touching a nut kills you, you're supposed to die.
Peter, does that joke fit with your theory?
Yeah, it does. It's actually one of my favorites. So Louis C.K. is really, as you said, he's a master of doing this. And he's really an excellent example because Joel, my co-author of The Humor Code, and I had a really uncomfortable interaction with Louis C.K.
Yes.
In which he, a part of it, he dismissed the benign violation theory. He says, oh, it can't be, you know, it just can't be that simple. It's just too complex. But what that bit, I think, illustrates very nicely is that you don't have to understand what makes things funny to be funny. Stand-up comedians have been acting without a theory for, you know, since they started doing stand-up. And what Louis does with the "of course, but maybe" joke is he says something, you know, potentially unpopular. You know, he's talking about the death of allergic children, and what he does is spend a lot of time finding a way to make this okay. And so he's like, of course, we should do all these things. We should make sure they're safe. We should make these safe. And then in this sort of like hypothetical kind of way, in a way that's not really serious, he says he presents the violation and it gets that big, big laugh. You know, you're playing on the arousal of saying something wrong in a way that an audience will accept.
In your book, The Humor Code, you travel around the world from Tanzania to Japan to Scandinavia. But let's start in the U.S., where you say there's actually quite a bit of humor diversity depending on what part of the country you're in. So what makes, say, Texas humor different than Alaska or Minnesota humor?
Well, you probably could answer that better than I.
I'm from California originally, so I'm still trying to get a hang of the whole Texas humor myself.
Yeah, and so I actually would argue that in some ways you're probably better suited to do that. So one of the things that we found during our Humor Code travels is this idea of how the outsider seems to have some advantage when it comes to being funny.
Huh.
So if you look at, for instance, comedy in the United States, how it's populated disproportionately by minorities.
Yes.
And the reason that there's some kind of societal reasons for that, opportunities and so on. But part of the reason is this idea of W.E.B. Du Bois talked about two-ness, this idea that you're both half in and half outside of a culture. And when you're not fully inside of a culture, you can see all the things that are wrong and peculiar about it. And that makes for very good comedy fodder. And so when you're in it totally, everything seems normal. And in our vernacular, everything's benign. But the reason that the U.S. has these sort of many different sort of forms of comedy is just the diversity that comes with being in a big country like this and being in a country that's populated by so many different types of people. So one of the things about humor that's really fascinating is how it's uniquely individual everybody's sense of humor is like a snowflake. In the sense that what's wrong and what's okay to them, what's benign and what's a violation, depends on their culture, their own personal experiences, where they are developmentally, and so on and so forth. And so it's very hard for an Alaskan and a Texan to sort of joke about the same things, at least certainly the same things that are local, because those two localities are so completely different.
Well, that leads me right to my next question, which is two very different localities. From Texas to Tanzania, that's one of the countries you visited on your search for what makes people laugh. And Tanzania isn't a random stop. It's the site of a so-called laughter epidemic. What's the story here?
Yeah, so Joel and I were really drawn to Tanzania because we came across these reports of an alleged laughter epidemic that happened there in the early 1960s. And it started out sort of innocently enough. A group of schoolgirls in this Christian boarding school started laughing in class and couldn't stop and wouldn't stop. And this laughter spread throughout the school. Eventually, they shut the school down, sent these girls back home to their villages, where they took this laughing disease, as it was described, back to these villages. And so there's academic journal articles trying to explain this and so on. And we thought this would be a really good location to explore, why do we laugh? Like, why do we engage in this sort of peculiar behavior? And so we went there and visited the school and talked to the authorities and tried to figure this out.
And what did you find?
Well, so it did seem to truly be laughter, but it wasn't laughter in the way that we think of laughter as indicating this, that we're having a good time. Mm. So one of the facts about laughter that is really surprising is that not all laughter indicates that someone's having a humorous experience. So there's this the technical term is Duchenne versus non-Duchenne laughter. Duchenne laughter is this sort of joyous, delightful laughter that we have when I manage to tell a successful joke to someone. And non-Duchenne laughter is people basically faking it, right? And so that's the kind of laughter you have when your boss tells a bad joke, but you don't want to be impolite. Or it's this laughter that people use to punctuate their sentences outside of their awareness, this sort of overlearned language style that they have. And it's a kind of unconscious way to kind of facilitate an interaction. The laughter that these young girls were experiencing in these, you know, hundreds and thousands of people in Tanzania was actually a special case of what's called mass motor hysteria. And mass motor hysteria is a psychosomatic reaction to stress. And typically you get more displays of negative emotions, crying and wailing and gnashing of teeth and people having fits and so on. And there's a long history of to present day of people reacting to stresses in this way. This just happened to be a quite peculiar case because it featured laughter.
We're talking today with Peter McGraw about his new book, the book he co-authored, The Humor Code. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372, by emailing think@kera.org, or by sending me a tweet. I'm @LSilverwoman. We'll be back with more from Peter McGraw after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. Our guest is Peter McGraw, co-author of the new book, The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. I thought we'd start this segment with what can be a bit of a touchy subject, and that's ethnic, racial, religious humor. And I want to play a clip by the stand-up comedian Angela Johnson.
So my Ling starts doing my nails right away. By the way, her American name is Tammy. You have boyfriend? No, I don't have a boyfriend. Honey, why you don't have? You look so pretty, like model, cheerleader, something pretty. You like long or short nails? Short nails, please, thanks. Oh, honey, that's why you don't have a boyfriend.
So there's a couple of things going on there, Peter. We've got imitation, cultural stereotypes, gender stereotypes. Are there any rules for who can get away with telling jokes about tricky subjects like race?
No, I certainly can't. So I think even with tenure, I think that's
you
that's
still don't have the right limits. To do it.
No. Yeah. So I think if you look at that clip, you know. That clip is a really interesting one in the sense that it's funny, in the sense that there are people laughing at that, even if you or I or a listener finds it perplexing or finds it offensive. That's one of the things that's really difficult about the science of humor, is that the very same humor attempt makes one person laugh, another person groan, and yet another person yawn, And as a result, it's often very difficult to see, well, how could that be okay, right? Because really, as you pointed out, the violations are very clear there, mm-hmm. right? You're sort of, you know, this comic is making fun of this woman, is imitating her voice, is playing on, as you say, these different stereotypes, which by and large don't typically hold. And then how is it that she's able to do this in such a way that actually gets laughter out of an audience, even if it's just a subset?
Now, we live in a very PC, politically correct time, but it seems like we have this type of humor and it really takes off. Is there a way, when we hear these types of jokes, that we feel both guilty and entertained? And is that discomfort what makes us laugh?
Well, I think good comedy really does play on arousal. So if you think about it, things that are wrong, violations, so talking about stereotypes, making fun of people, they create this level of anxiousness, nervousness, what we call arousal. And Freud recognized that, that of course, without some doing it successfully, you just experience those negative emotions. But when you can find a way, as Louis C.K. did, to switch it and make it okay to actually think of this this idea, to be receptive to this idea, you end up switching the sign, and what was negative becomes positive, or at least partially positive. So you may experience like nervous laughter. So the idea is that nervous laughter basically is the recognition that you're laughing at something that you realize I probably shouldn't be laughing at.
Now, if you're looking for a country with a completely different take on what's comedic, from reading your book, it seems like you should head to Japan, which is a place where you say what's funny is sometimes sadistic game shows, pornographic anime, and intergalactic battle robots. yeah. Why is humor so different there?
Well, yeah, so when we started the Humor Code project, our friends, it was the only place that everybody we talked to said, oh, you need to go to Japan because you need to explain Japanese comedy to me because I just don't get it. So one big reason is just language, right? So when you don't share the same language as another culture, it becomes very difficult to communicate. So you're missing out on some of the message. But some of it is that the Japanese, they don't have the same Judeo-Christian grounding that that we do in the U.S. And so they have a whole set of other norms that are in play when it comes to when it comes to comedy. And so the things that are wrong and the things that are okay to the Japanese can often be very different than to someone from the United States.
So what is their version of, you know, the Daily Show? What's funny that they would play?
Oh, well, one of the striking things that we found is that there is very little political comedy in Japan. And that is that they just don't have the same level of satire, that in many ways criticizing the government in a comedic way is just not okay to do. And what the Japanese do to a much greater degree than we do in the United States is borrow from old comedy in the United States, this sort of two-man comedy where you have the straight guy and the clown, or these variety shows, so these sort of sadistic game shows. So Joel and I actually visited one of them, the set of one of them, where these people are being subjected to really painful procedures. And it seems you're just like, I can't believe that people find this funny, until you realize that the contestants on the game shows are comedians.
Oh.
And so what you don't know as an American watching a Japanese game show is that the people who are participating are comics. They're doing this because they're pursuing fame, and they're doing this and making jokes along the way, which I think helps make the terrible things that are happening to them a little bit more enjoyable.
Now, laughter is also seen as medicine in many places, and you describe a booming laughter industry where there's this focus on humor as healthy, laughter yoga, humor rooms in hospitals. What do we know about laughter as medicine?
Well, we have good reason to believe that laughter and humor are going to be helpful, help us deal with the stresses and strains of life. The research on this still has a long way to go. I'll give you my best case for why this is true. But you have to remember, keep this in the back of your mind, is sometimes you really just need that shot of penicillin. that in many ways, laughter is not the best medicine, but it's good medicine. It's a nice supplement to the things that you need to do when you're really experiencing the stresses and strains of life. So first of all, experiencing positive emotion, being in a positive emotional state, being happy, being joyous, experiencing amusement, that helps buffer us. That it improves our immune functioning. It helps us just keep the kind of outlook that we need to be able to deal with the negative things in life. The second thing is that having a good sense of humor ends up being critical, not just because you can produce things that are funny that make you feel better, but that people with a good sense of humor are widely liked. It's a highly desirable trait. And so when the chips are down, who is it that you're more likely to want to support, to stick with during those troubled times? Is your friend, your family member, who can be cheerful, who can be funny?
So it's a survival instinct in a way.
It is. It musters social support. And social support very clearly helps us when the chips are down. And then the last thing, and this one I think is the one that we haven't looked enough at, is that if you can joke about a tragedy, if you can laugh in the face of calamity, that in many ways it changes the way you see that tragedy. It robs those scary things in the world of their teeth. And when you no longer appraise something as bad as you did originally, it's not going to affect you as much. And so in that way, it really seems to be a good tool for coping.
Did you find darker humor in places where people were more upset or with more difficult times in terms of politics or their economic situation? I know you visited some places that are definitely in that category. You visited, for example, Palestine.
We did, yeah. So we went to Palestine, and we made a bold prediction before we landed in the Middle East. We said that Palestine was going to be hilarious. And our friends and family scoffed at that idea, and for good reason, right? If you think about a difficult place to be right now, it certainly would be in the West Bank, and yet we knew that anywhere that you can find challenges, if you can find people who are resisting those challenges, the hardy individuals, the people who are criticizing the folks who were responsible for their problems, you're going to find good comedy. And that very definitely was the case. And I would say, sure, the Palestinians had a little bit of a dark view at times. So we hung out with a comedy troupe that had a satire television show on Palestinian national TV. And they were pointing out not only what was wrong with the Israelis, but with the Palestinian government and with pretty much everyone else in the world, Osama, Obama, and so on, as satirists tend to do. But we also found something really interesting about the Palestinians, and that is that a lot of their jokes had a sort of self-deprecating element to them, and in many ways seemed a little bit more stereotypically Jewish than you might have expected. And in some ways, that makes sense in hindsight, in the sense that you can, with self-deprecation, you can really disarm people. And I think that there's a sort of long history within the Jewish community of how that is a useful tool in terms of making a way in a world that can be quite anti-Semitic.
We have an email from someone here, Travis Crockett. He says he wants to know if hysterical laughter or laughter at the absurdity of a situation is different from other kinds of laughter. And he points to the saying, you have to laugh or you're going to cry.
Yeah, so this notion of if you don't laugh, you'll cry, I think really is connected to this idea of benign violations, that it's a very thin line between a world that we see as good and okay and a world that we see as bad and wrong. So certainly the case of hysterical laughter is an interesting one. The work that's been done on it is really quite sparse, but one of the things that it highlights is this idea of how social humor is. That when you're laughing so hard and it's sort of going on and on and on, there's usually other people there who are participating. And you get this kind of contagion effect. So part of the reason that laughter is contagious is that it serves as a signal that something that seems wrong is actually okay. And so from an evolutionary perspective, you could see how that would be useful to be able to spread this message across people, especially if it's people who don't yet have language, so our predecessors and even non-human primates, so apes, bonobos, chimps, and so on. The idea that laughter serves as a signal in which you don't actually need language.
Now, how do you explain a lot of people say, well, oh, a good joke, it's got to have some element of surprise to it. You know, you've got to get that zinger in that you're like, oh, I didn't see that coming. But what about jokes you can hear over and over again and you just laugh every time?
Yeah, so that's actually a fairly striking critique of at least some forms of incongruity theory. So if you ask the average person on the street what makes things funny, they'll say surprise. And you highlight one challenge to that. So one of the reasons that I think surprise does tend to accompany very funny things is that it helps create that arousing situation. It helps create the delight that we have. And it helps because a good joke that has that twist often puts the appraisal, the view that something's wrong and okay, right next to each other. And you need both of those elements. So the fact is that when you watch, you know, your favorite comedy movie over and over again, and you find a scene funny over and over again, shows that you don't need surprise, but typically what you have about that scene is there's still some pretty big violation there that you're able to see as okay. And you know, eventually that scene will become just okay because you'll become so used to it in the same way that you become so used to a pop song that it no longer has that emotional drama to it anymore.
Now, one question that comes up there is if you go to a comedy show and after you're listening, say it's a two-hour comedy show, do the jokes become less funny by the second hour? Do they wear off?
So this is a little secret that we learned about comedians is that they start with their more modest mm-hmm. jokes, and they typically ramp them up as the show goes on. And there's two reasons for that. One is that the prior laughs help make subsequent jokes funnier. And so you and then some of this idea of adaptation will show me more and more and more. And so you get this kind of crescendo that can happen within a show. So if you can imagine switching a show up where the stuff that a comedian finishes with, they start with, and the stuff they start with, they finish with, is probably not going to be as successful a show.
So it's okay if you miss the first part. It's like the previews to the movie.
Well, yeah, and here's the thing is that the best part of a stand-up set typically is the very last bit, the closer. That's the strongest stuff.
Yeah, those usually are the ones that get you. We're talking today with Peter McGraw about the new book he co-authored. It's called The Humor Code. Join the conversation. Call us 800-933-5372. You can also email us, think@kera.org. Or send me a tweet. I'm @LSilverwoman. And we'll be back to talk more with Peter McGraw after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
I'm thinking about the wig historically. I guess the Revolutionary War was the last war fought in wigs, and it seems like that must have been hard. You know, they're going into battle, you think, well, do I have my bullets? Do I have my bobby pins? You know, you got to make sure you have everything. A lot more to worry about. What if I get killed? Is my wig on straight? I don't know when the whole wig thing came into style for a man, but I know when it went out. When the mirror was invented.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. Our guest today is Peter McGraw. He is co-author of The Humor Code. And that, of course, was Jerry Seinfeld on Seinfeld. The show was a classic, but listening to it now sounds a bit dated. Peter, how has humor on TV evolved in the past few decades?
Oh, wow. So one of the things about humor, well, comedy, is that it's just exploded, certainly in the last, 5 to 10 years. And it's not just on TV, it's everywhere. So the reason that it's exploded, I think, is twofold. One is there's just more channels now. So there's just more opportunities to present your comedy and to segment it. So to create a show that fits a very narrow demographic. So if you think about a show like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, so that's a show that is really not going to appeal to all the types of people who enjoyed a Seinfeld, for instance, but it has a really loyal viewership. And then, while your show is going on, we're tweeting along with it. And Twitter really has become a home to comics. So it's a place for them to try out material it's a place for us to follow funny people and to be sort of entertained in these little bits and pieces throughout the day. And so what you're just finding is more opportunities and then just a broadening of the types of people who can now reach the masses.
We have someone on the phones here, Michael in Dallas. He says, I think he's a comedian. Is that right, Michael?
Yes, I am a stand-up comic, huh?
Oh, awesome. Yeah. Well, will it put you on the spot if I ask you to give me a one-liner?
It would. I don't tell. No, it would. We don't react like that. Some comics can do one-liners, but most comics are. It's like a storyline. I mean, they
there's a build-up.
Yeah, it's just a build-up to one maybe big joke, like my family. A lot of things about my family is everybody's very country, and words don't come off of their tongue like a normal person. Like a normal person would say, is that a toad or a frog? I mean, in the country, they'd be like, is that a toad or a frog? I mean, what in the world is a toad or a frog? I mean, it's like, that's my comedy. And like he was saying, I mean, comedy has exploded as well. Peter, I plan on going out and get your book, but great interview. I want to put a comfort level to people. I mean, it's hard to be funny for 2 hours, something that you said in the last segment. It's hard to be funny for 2 hours, but usually comedy shows are between three comics. You got your opener, you got your feature, and you got your headliner. And I've only seen Dave Chappelle do 2 hours and 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. That was at the Improv. So, but usually the build-up comes. I mean, each comic gets funnier and funnier, and then when you get to the headliner, they're already ready to laugh, so everything is easy for the headliner. So that's the good thing.
Now, Michael, when you are going out to do a show, how much do you change your jokes depending on the audience and sort of who you see out there?
Well, a lot, depending on what type of audience. Like, if I know if I'm in East St. Louis, I know I got to be completely blue, you know. if I'm at a church, I know I got to be completely clean. But if I'm at, like, a college, I know I could be both. You know what I mean? So, I mean, you just have to cater your comedy to, you know, exactly your audience. I mean, if you got a completely white crowd, you want to do white comedy if you're a black comic. But that's hard sometimes. But at the same time, if you got a completely black crowd, that's the hardest crowd you can ever have.
Really? Why?
Because black folks, they waiting on you to make them laugh. You see what I'm saying? White people get it immediately. They be like, okay, that wasn't... Black people are like, that wasn't funny to me. That really wasn't funny. A white person will go ahead and give you a chuckle or something like that. So it's different. It's totally different, especially on the Chitlin circuit.
Now, do you believe that there might be a formula for what makes something funny? Do you follow any type of cookbook?
The one thing I think, if it's funny to me because I'm a funny guy, I write it down. And I'll try it out at the open mic night or something like that. But I'm from the old school. So I take the styrofoam balls and I put them up on sticks. And I do my show to styrofoam balls with smiley faces or straight faces, or it could be somebody just sitting there with no face on the ball. A lot of people don't really realize that, but that's what I do. If you want to be good, you want to be able to talk to anybody.
Great. Thanks so much, Michael. I appreciate it. Peter, so did you hear from a lot of comedians' reactions to your book and whether they were upset or agreed with your theories?
Yeah, so we get some mixed reactions. So Michael's reaction is fairly typical. So there's kind of I see how it connects. One thing about comics, about funny people in general, is that they're smart. That the act of taking something that's wrong and okay, you know, and putting those things together is not easy. And so you got to be smart to do it, and you got to be smart to recognize it. And so these folks are nerds in a sense, and so I can usually bring them around with enough anecdotes, stories, studies, and so on. If you think about it, what comics are doing is they're actually acting like scientists or empiricists. So he said, I go out to open mic night, I try out the joke. So they're actually testing their jokes. They're collecting data. And it gets a laugh. Well, how might I make it better? Well, they may tweak it and change it. So going back to the clip of Louis C.K., I can assure you that when he first told that joke, it wasn't that funny. Mm-hmm. But he saw something in it, and he kept working on it. If you watch the video clip of him, he actually is behaving really uncomfortable. So he has this really awkward posture and these facial grimaces, like, I can't believe I'm saying this.
It sounds almost like you're describing this process of cooking or someone who becomes a chef where you have this recipe and you're following it and you might, you know, having a good recipe, that's important, but you really have to be able to tweak it and change it depending on who you're serving it to and what they like.
It is. That's a very nice way to do it and to see it. And the way I think about it is it's theater. So the stand-up is the writer, the producer, and the performer. And it takes some time to get it right.
We have someone on the phones here, Nancy from Granbury. She says she wants to know something about comedy and children. Are you there, Nancy?
I am.
What's your question for us?
Well, I am a ventriloquist, so I'm basically a stand-up comic for children. And I've really enjoyed this hour. Can't wait to read the book. And so I just wondered what your guest had found about comedy for children, how it's different, how children react differently, because I do the same thing, you know, did a library show today and I know tomorrow what I won't do. So I just thought he might speak to comedy for children.
Interesting. Peter?
Yeah, so we're in almost totally uncharted territory when you start talking about this children's sense of humor. So there's been very little research on this. There's a gentleman named Paul McGee who's done some work on it. He has a book about comedy, but really it's tough to say. So and the reason is with children is that there are these very clear developmental stages, and with those developmental stages there's emotional changes. There's also cognitive changes. So, for instance, one of the kind of perplexing things is, why do children laugh at peekaboo? Right? So why is it that a young child will delight in peekaboo? And why is it that they, at some point, stop delighting in it? And it seems to have to do with this idea of object permanence, that once children realize that their parent is not gone when they cover their face, then the violation is gone. The sense that something's wrong or amiss is gone. But the child who doesn't have object permanence, who actually really thinks that their parent has disappeared, starts to experience that negativity. They get upset, and then their parents reappear, and then they delight in this. Oh, mom's back. And so when you think about, with each stage, as children get older and older, they accumulate experiences. They're developing cognitively and emotionally. It really makes it very difficult to try to really hone in on these things. Your caller has got a tough job.
Well, thanks, Nancy. Now, what about humor? This is a question from Jeff. What about humor that isn't particularly funny but tends to foster feelings of warmth, i.e. dad jokes?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Yeah, so I guess that there certainly is kind of these it's sort of a meta joke, right? So it's a...
Do you have an example of a dad joke for us? I'm trying to think of one.
Well, so there's certainly dad... He may be referring to dad humor.
Yes, so, yes, yes.
So dad humor is real. So one is... what is it? We're off like a turd of hurdles. I have a friend whose dad always says that. So one of the things about dad humor that's interesting is that it's not that a dad's joke is not funny. It's just that dad's joke is not funny to his kids. So a buddy of mine wrote an essay about this, and we were talking about it. And what it is he thinks his dad's not funny. His dad thinks that his dad's not funny, but my friend thinks his grandfather is hilarious.
Ah, separation there.
Yeah, so the idea is that you've been subjected to your dad's jokes your whole life, and they're no longer novel, fun, interesting, and they probably happen a little too often, right? There's only, you can only hear we're off like a turd of hurdles so many times before you just can't take it anymore. And so you have like this affection for your father, but, you know, he's definitely worn a little thin.
Yeah.
But when your friends hear his jokes and they think that's great, oh my God, your dad is hysterical.
It's also a little bit of the unexpected that helps there. Now, if you're giving advice to people who are trying to tell jokes, maybe they're not going to be, you know, Louis C.K. or Key and Peele or any of the people who are well known. What do you tell them about trying to put together a joke or timing on how to tell it?
Yeah, so I have a few things that I've been that I try to tell people. So one is that you have to be willing to try. You have to believe that you can get better at this. And the only way you're going to get better is to do what your caller, the stand-up, does, is to try these things out and kind of try to get better at it. One of the places to start is look for the thing that's wrong. Look for the things that's potentially uncomfortable or amiss and seems a little bit strange. Look for the violation. That's a great place to start when it comes to a joke. And then the idea is, how do you find a way to make it okay in some way? You know, some of it's just knowing your audience. The other thing that I say is that you should be quick to apologize. To recognize that you're on a thin line, and that an honest, "I'm sorry, I was trying to be funny," response is going to be much better accepted than, "Hey, I was kidding. I was just kidding." You know, that kind of thing where the person, the joke teller, ends up being really defensive. That ends up mattering, I think, because people will give you a lot more leeway if they believe that you're trying to behave in a way that's supposed to be fun. And if you're trying to unite people, mm-hmm. that is, you're trying to be inclusive versus exclusive. So be very cautious of who your target is. So if you're trying to be funny, take aim at yourself. That's the best place to start.
That's good advice.
So when I give my talks, I say, I've learned that it's important to be funny right away. And then I point at myself and I say, hence the sweater vest.
Are you wearing the sweater vest right now?
I'm not. It's too hot in Boulder today to wear the sweater vest. But I wear a sweater vest, you know, when I work. And so that, you know, so that's a good way to do it. No one really can be offended by that joke, you know.
Yeah.
Especially not me.
So the sort of culmination of the book you co-authored, and I'm not giving anything away here, is a comedy performance you gave in Montreal at the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival. And it was a much bigger venue than your other stand-up routine in a Denver dive bar, as you described it. What was the best joke you told? And don't be offended if I don't laugh.
Well, so one of the jokes that I tell is about our experience in Japan. So in Osaka, Osaka is the funniest city in Japan. And allegedly, you could walk up to someone in Japan and make, like, point at them with your fingers as if it was a gun and go bang. And they'll act like they've been shot. And so the idea that I had was, if that really is the case, you could then go about robbing banks in the same way, where you head into the bank with your fingers ablaze. The only problem with that is that that you really can't stuff your imaginary sacks filled with all the money that they give you.
Oh, our guest today is Peter McGraw, co-author of The Humor Code and director of the University of Colorado's Humor Research Lab. Peter McGraw, thanks again for being with us today.
That was a great pleasure.
I'm Lauren Silverman, in again for Chris Boyd, and Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy.